everyone, and welcome to the fourth anniversary Charm Telecon. We've been doing these telecons now through the whole Prime mission, and this is kind of the wrap up of the Prime. It's part one of the wrap up. My name is Jane Houston Jones. I'm with Cassini Outreach, and I'll be your moderator today. We have three speakers today. Dr. Linda Spilker, who is our deputy scientist here on the Cassini mission. She's been on Cassini since 1988, and before that, she was on the Voyager mission for 13 years. So she has a lot of wonderful experiences here on planetary missions at JPL. Our two speakers after Linda does an introduction are Dr. Andy Ingersoll from Caltech. He's a professor of planetary sciences and a member of the imaging team, the Cassini imaging team. Also joining us today is Elizabeth Turtle, and she goes by the name Zibby, and she's at APL, the Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins University, and is also on the imaging team. So what I'm going to do is remind everyone, if you do ask questions, to say your name before you ask the question so that the talk can be recorded. So that your name will be recorded. And if you need to make noise or anything, you can mute your phone. Hopefully, most of you can mute your phone by pressing *6. And those of you who can't, that's fine too. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Linda.
Okay, thank you very much, Jane. This is a very special anniversary for Cassini. It's a four-year anniversary. It's the end of what we call our Prime mission, and the completion of something like 76 orbits around Saturn, including 45 Titan flybys and a host of close flybys of icy satellites. And you'll be hearing me here. I have an echo.
Linda, are you on a speakerphone, or did you pick
the phone? No, I picked it up. I'll go ahead in spite of the echo. Yeah, 45 Titan flybys and a host of icy satellite flybys. If you go to the slide, Huygens and Cassini, the scientists and the machines, the mission was named after two scientists. The first was Christian Huygens, and he was a Dutch scientist who actually discovered Titan, so it's quite appropriate that the Huygens-Titan mission would be named after him, and as well, he discovered the true nature of Saturn's rings, that Galileo initially saw what he thought were two large moons on either side of Saturn, and then they disappeared for a while, and they came back, and it was Huygens who determined that they were actually rings around Saturn. Giovanni Domenico Cassini was an Italian-French astronomer, and he was the one who discovered a gap between two of Cassini's rings, the A and the B ring, named the Cassini division in his honor. And he also discovered several of Saturn's satellites, including Iapetus, Rhea, Tethys, and Dione. On page 4 are photographs of the Cassini orbiter and the Huygens probe. And to give you an idea of just how large this spacecraft is, you can see around the bottom of the Cassini orbiter, you can see little figures. Those are people dressed up in special suits for working on the spacecraft, to give you an idea of just how big the entire spacecraft is. And that gold-covered object is the Huygens probe, and it's shown without its thermal blankets on the right-hand side of the page. Going on to page 5, the Cassini spacecraft, you can see it is indeed a very large spacecraft. It's 22 feet tall. That high-gain antenna, the white antenna at the top, has a diameter of 13 feet. And the spacecraft itself has a mass of about 2.8 tons. And if you include the fuel for the spacecraft as well as the Huygens probe, then you're looking at something like a 6-ton spacecraft. And the sheer size of Cassini helps explain why we didn't take the direct route to Saturn, but instead had two flybys of Venus, a close flyby of Earth, and then of Jupiter to give us the additional gravitational assist to go on out to Saturn. The power of Cassini at Saturn orbit insertion, that's the time on July 1st, 2004 we first arrived, was about 700 watts. And Cassini is powered by three radioisotope thermoelectric generators, shown on the diagram, and that plutonium power source that we use the heat from the plutonium decay to power the entire spacecraft. And that is slowly decreasing with time, so we have a little bit less power every year as
question.
The mission has gone on. Yes.
Question?
Yes, what's the question?
This is Matthew Ota with the Saturn Observation Campaign. I'm just curious as to the amount of propellant left for the main engines, the 490 Newton engines.
Right,
Right,
I'm not sure of the exact number, although I know that we have certainly used over half of our fuel, and a great deal of that was used just to go into orbit around Saturn. So I don't have an exact number for you, though.
But those facts will be part of the super-duper cool facts in next month's Charm Telecon, which will be part two of this fourth year anniversary. We're collecting all those metrics for
the. Andy Ingersoll, in practical terms, we can go on for another 10 years with the fuel we've got.
Right,
right, right. Yes, we tend to use the fuel primarily for trajectory correction maneuvers when we are in close to Titan or various targets. Then we have reaction wheels that we use to actually turn the spacecraft. So that makes it a much less fuel-intensive mission to, say, something like compared to the Voyager mission. Let's see, for the spacecraft, we have a 0.5 gigabit recorder, and the Huygens probe by itself weighed about 700 pounds, and the Huygens probe is what we sent into the atmosphere of Titan, and via parachutes it dropped down to the surface and sent back data about the atmosphere and pictures, including great images once it landed on the surface. On board Cassini we have a set of 12 scientific instruments, including, they're sort of in three groups, the optical remote sensing instruments, which measure from the ultraviolet into the far infrared, have some microwave remote sensing instruments, including a radar instrument, and we actually use the high-gain antenna for radio science experiments. And then there's a suite of magnetospheric and plasma instruments, including a dust analyzer, an instrument that measures the magnetic field, and additional instruments that measure electrons, protons, and ions in the Saturn system. Moving on to page 6, if you look at the bottom of page 6, there are little asterisks with the instrument names indicating each of the places where the instruments the various instruments are commanded, or the instrument operations are run from these locations. So you can see that we have 10 of the instruments in the United States, and two of those whose activities are run, one in England and one in Germany. Moving on to page 7, Cassini is truly an international mission, and this is represented by the 17 flags that are shown here surrounding Cassini. These various countries provided not only scientists, there's about 250 scientists on Cassini, but also engineers and various pieces of the spacecraft and instruments that were built in countries around the world. About a third of the Cassini scientists are international scientists, and the other two-thirds are U.S. scientists. Moving on to page 8, the cost of Cassini, the total cost is about $3 billion, and that's spread between NASA, about $2.5 billion for NASA, and about $0.5 billion for Huygens. And if you spread that over the roughly, not quite 20 years of the mission, that's about $150 million per year, although the current operating costs for Cassini, since we're just in the operations phase and aren't building the spacecraft, are about $80 million per year. To put things in perspective, the Cassini budget is roughly at 0.5% of the NASA annual budget. And to further put that in perspective, the NASA annual budget is about 1.7% of the U.S. discretionary spending, or about 0.6% of the U.S. budget. So you can sort of do the math and see that of the total U.S. budget, Cassini isn't really a very small part of that. Moving on to page 9, just to give you an idea about the Saturn system and how huge it is, what's shown here is the planet Saturn and its rings, plus the Earth and the Moon, each of them shown to scale, and the distance between the Earth and the Moon is to scale as well. So you can see that this is indeed an immense system, and Andy will be talking more about the planet itself in his discussions, but you can see that the Saturn plus the rings would just fit in between the Earth and the Moon, and it certainly dwarfs the Earth. Moving on to page 10, this is again continuing as an overview of the Saturnian system. So far, we've discovered between ground-based and also Cassini, we're now up to a count of about 60 moons around Saturn. And they come in all different shapes and sizes. Titan is the largest of those. It could be a planet in its own right had it formed elsewhere in the solar system. And it has a thick nitrogen atmosphere with methane and other hydrocarbons in it, and that'll be something that'll be discussed in more detail at the CHARM Telecon in July. And as you can see, the tiny satellites, the ones closest to Saturn, are toward the left, and you can see that they come in irregular shapes. They aren't necessarily spherical balls. They might indeed be fragments left over from the breakup of perhaps larger objects. And then as the moons get larger, you can see that they become more spherical in shape, although Hyperion and Phoebe both have irregular shapes as well. In the bottom panel, it shows the ring system. The rings have very simple names, basically just A through G, and they were named in their order of discovery. And it also shows with the gold-colored arrows the locations that various spacecraft have flown through the Saturn system, including Pioneer 11 and Voyager 2, Voyager 1 and 2, and then Cassini, which flew through the system at the closest point between the rings. One of the rings of note is the E-ring. We now know that Enceladus is indeed the source of that ring, that there are jets of material coming out of the South Pole. And Zibby Turtle will talk about that in more detail in this telecon. Going on to page 11, well, what did the tour look like this fourth year of the tour? What the goal in the final year was to basically go up to very high inclinations, in fact, the very highest inclinations that we have of the mission to date. There are roughly 27 orbits in this fourth year of the mission. That was roughly 10 sequences that we had to send up to Cassini. It included 13 targeted flybys and 7 non-targeted flybys, where we just picked non-targeted distance of about 120,000 kilometers or less. In the fourth year of the tour, we started Cassini in a set of equatorial orbits, and those are a good opportunity to get icy satellite flybys, and including one of Iapetus that we flew very close to in September of 2007 and got back some remarkable data about this very interesting moon with one side as white as snow and one side as dark as charcoal. And I'm sure that Zibby will have a lot of highlights from that flyby. We also had two very low non-targeted flybys, one of Rhea in August and one of Epimetheus, which is one of two cool orbital satellites, in December of 2007. And then we had our last targeted Enceladus flyby of the Prime mission, and that was in March of this year. And it was the closest we had yet come to this object, and we got some really incredible data. We actually flew through the jets and plumes of material, and we were able to do in-situ sampling, and I'm sure that Zibby will talk more about that as well. Well, then we spent most of the fourth year after the Iapetus flyby increasing the inclination, and we're now at an inclination of over 70 degrees, and that's a wonderful opportunity to look down at the north and south poles of the planet. The rings open up like a giant bullseye, and it's also a good time for in-situ sampling, especially in the regions over the poles, what we call the open field line region, the region through which the aurora are generated, to understand more about Saturn's auroral processes. So this is really a very exciting and a very new time, in the sense that we're getting to see Saturn in a way that no one has seen it before from these very high inclinations. And also, we've begun work on our two-year extended mission. We're in the process of putting those sequences together, because obviously it starts on July 1st of this year. And then also are looking ahead to what we call an extended mission, which would be in the period after what we're calling the Cassini Equinox mission, or the first extended mission. And we're hoping that perhaps we might be able to go as long as even 7 years, all the way to the solstice for Saturn. So that would be very exciting indeed, and those plans are in the works. Going on to page 12, this is a mission summary chart. It gives you, and the box on the far right just indicates the activities in the final year of Cassini's activity, where we are talking a year now that goes from July 1st of 2007 to July 1st of 2008. You can see some of the highlights there. The targeted Iapetus flyby is indicated. The blue triangle is the close Enceladus flyby. And you can see indicated that the inclination profile is shown as a function of time in the tour, that we are indeed in very high inclinations in the remaining weeks, and that it also will be in these very high inclinations for the first part of the Cassini Equinox mission. On page 13 is just a list of the targeted flybys, so including the Titan flybys, Iapetus, and Enceladus. And also included in this table are the dates where we flew by these various targets. And if you're interested in going in and looking at some of the data, the radar maps from the Titan passes or the images associated with them, you can use these dates to go into go from the Cassini webpage to go into and actually look at some of the data and images that have come back from these flybys. And with that, I'm going to turn over the discussion to Dr. Andy Ingersoll, and he will tell you about some of the highlights from the Saturn flyby. And I believe you have to skip to, I think it's page 55.
Correct.
In the presentation to get to Andy's material.
Hi there. I'll tell a few jokes or at least stall for time while you skip to page 55. You should see a blank white page with, except for the words, Saturn's atmosphere. Results from Cassini, Andrew P. Ingersoll, June 24th. And that is my topic, indeed. I will sort of end on a few remarks about Saturn's interior. It's obviously harder when you're in an orbiter to sample or measure anything about the interior, but we hope to be able to do that. The Prime mission was not the best way to do it, but there's interesting possibilities for later on to measure Saturn's interior. Now, move on to page 2, and there is an early in the mission picture of Saturn and its rings. And the sun in this picture, you can actually tell where the sun is from the terminator. The terminator is the boundary between day and night on the planet. And you can see that the terminator is sort of tipped over, indicating that the sun is maybe at the 4 o'clock position, treating noon as being straight up in this picture. And there's a very curious thing about this picture. I'll give you 15 seconds to spot it. The northern hemisphere of Saturn, which is peaking, which is getting some illumination through the rings from the sun, which is down at the 4 o'clock position, looks blue. And it's a different color, and we scratched our heads about that for a long time. Remember, this is an image taken early on, probably 2004, maybe early 2005. And the ring scientists said, why is the atmosphere blue? And the atmospheric scientists said, well, why is light that shines through the rings colored blue? And so each side was blaming the other for the blue color. Now, in 2008, we have figured it out because the sun is approaching the equinox season when it's more, in this diagram, it would be at the 3 o'clock position. And the northern hemisphere is receiving direct sunlight, not filtered through the rings. And at first, when we saw direct sunlight, it still looked blue. And so we couldn't blame the rings for that because it wasn't being filtered through the rings. And now that we're the northern hemisphere has been baked in sunlight for a year or so, it's turning pink, or whatever that color of the southern hemisphere is in this image. So it seems to be some kind of chemical change in the atmosphere, smog, if you like, forming the way smog forms in the under the action of sunlight. And in fact, it could have some of the same ingredients as smog, little particles of soot, hydrocarbons, in other words, condensing out from the mixture of hydrocarbons that are the gaseous hydrocarbons, which are in the atmosphere. Methane is the primary one. That's one carbon and four hydrogen. So somehow the sunlight is turning some of the methane into smog, and it's beginning to look that pinkish orange, yellowish color instead of blue. When the blue skies is just the clean atmosphere, not getting very much sunlight, and when the northern hemisphere was behind the rings, it was clean. All right, let's move on. Talk about electrical storms. Lightning is a very interesting phenomenon. It's not even very well understood on Earth. The only place besides Earth where we know for sure that there's lightning is Jupiter. And that we know that because we look at the dark side of Jupiter and we see, of course, we see a dark planet, but we also see these lightning storms. Voyager discovered them. Galileo got a very good look at them. And so we said, well, let's look for the lightning storms on Saturn with Cassini. Next slide shows you one of the problems. This sort of double picture shows a little storm there. It's actually not too little. It's thousands of kilometers across. Remember, Saturn's a lot bigger than the Earth, 10 times bigger. And so this is like a, it's bigger than a hurricane on Earth, like a big winter storm on Earth. And it's producing lightning flashes. But we can't see them. We can hear them. We can hear them with the radio wave detector. It's the RPWS, plasma wave radio, something or other, detector on Cassini. And when this little storm comes around on the side of Saturn facing the spacecraft, we get these radio bursts. They're very short bursts, just like a short lightning burst. And then as the storm sets every Saturn day, it sets and goes on to the other side of Saturn, where the spacecraft can't hear the or can't collect the radio signals. We don't hear them. And then it comes around again a half a Saturn day later, and we get the bursty radio signals. And the reason we haven't seen them visually, even though we do get good views of the dark side of the planet, or let me call it the night side of the planet, is that the night side of the planet is not very dark. And the reason for that is that you've got these enormous rings scattering light from the sun and filling the sky from the point of view of someone floating in a balloon in Saturn's atmosphere. So the rings fill the sky, and the brightness on the night side of Saturn is brighter than a full moon, than the Earth at night under a full moon. Even though the sun is only 1% as bright, and the sun, of course, illuminates our full moon. The sun also illuminates Saturn's rings, but the Saturn's rings are such a much bigger portion of the sky that the overall brightness on the ground on Saturn, if there were ground, is brighter than a full moon. And so that means that it's never very dark, and the lightning flashes, which sort of have to filter up through the clouds, are, although we're probably getting some light from them, they're indistinguishable from all the little puffy clouds illuminated from above by the rings. And we can't tell clouds illuminated from below by lightning from the clouds illuminated from above. Back to this image here of this little storm. It's very interesting. There's long periods go by, up to a two years, where there is no radio waves signaling lightning. And then all of a sudden, within a day, the radio waves will start up. And the the RPWS instrument will pick them up and alert the imaging team. And if we happen to be in taking images, we can't respond that fast. But if we happen to be taking images, the storm, there'll be a new storm, these storms seem to pop up within a day and emit lightning as soon as they pop up. It turns out the people who are best able to spot the storm when the radio waves start up are the amateur astronomers here on Earth, who can just go out the next night and point their telescopes, and they say, yep, it wasn't there last night, and there tonight. It's been a very nice sort of coordinated effort between professional astronomers and amateur astronomers, and we're, of course, on the Cassini team, very grateful for their effort. The next slide, which is entitled Saturn Electrostatic Discharges Intensity, shows you sort of the history. You'll look at the bottom, you can see the day and the year from 2004 to 2006. And in the top panel, the black vertical lines are when the RPWS instrument was receiving these radio signals from the lightning. And you can see that there was around day 200 to 250 in year 2004, there was a lot of radio activity from lightning. Then there was a long pause, and around day 140 in 2005, there was a little whiff of lightning, and then a big storm started up in 2006. Each time, we never saw evidence of a storm in 2005, but there was a big storm during the radio episodes in 2004 and 2006. And now we got one going in 2008, which is much longer lived than the other two. It's been going for 6 months and still going strong. And that's the only source of lightning on the planet. The next slide, which is labeled planetocentric latitude and west longitude, shows a movie over 25 days of, I can't remember, I think this is the 2004 storm. Maybe it's the 2006 storm, actually. It's in a false color, a combination of three filters that are sensitive to cloud height. So the yellow are the highest clouds, and you can see the different active center sort of pops up suddenly, like alpha and beta, and then drifts west, and watch the alpha one in the left-hand column, as time goes by, time increases as you go down. It started off as a high cloud, that's the yellow color, and then it turned into, if you follow it into the right-hand column, into a blue cloud, actually blue signifying a hole in the cloud. And we don't fully understand why it goes from a very thick high cloud into a hole in the cloud, some kind of rebound where the clouds evaporate. Figuring this kind of stuff out, the first step is to gather the information and the data, and then the second step is to read all the books on Earth lightning and Earth thunderstorms, and then the final step is to put it all together into a new view of thunderstorms and lightning, and that's what we're trying to do right now. Obviously, lightning on a giant planet is not going to be quite the same as lightning on the Earth. Probably does involve water, probably does involve ice particles and raindrops, but there's no ocean underneath, there's no moist land, it's just a deeper atmosphere. So the hope, as with all of these kind of studies, is to understand more about the phenomenon in general. In this case, the phenomenon is electrical activity in the atmosphere, using a more a broader context than just studying the Earth alone. Next slide shows...
Question.
Yeah.
This is Trina. It looks like all the storms sort of appear at the 300 west longitude, even though after that they drift. Did those storms earlier also appear at 300 west longitude? And does that mean anything, that they're always...
Well, we wonder about that. The storms are spaced 2 years apart, and we wonder if maybe it's the same storm, but it just sort of went dormant for 2 years. Actually, if you go back one slide, I didn't talk about... This is the one entitled Saturn Electrostatic Discharges Intensity. I didn't talk about the lower panel, but you can see the answer to your question. The 2004 storm, which are these little black squiggles around 300 west longitude, were sort of drifting to higher longitude values. That means they were drifting to the west. And then, and that's the dashed line, sort of projecting that drift rate. And then nothing happened for 2 years. And then the 2006 storm started up at about 200 west longitude, having drifted almost once around the planet. And it's possible it's the same storm, but we don't really know. And so back to the next slide, it's possible that there's a active storm center, just as you were guessing, and then the clouds are lofted to higher altitudes where the winds are stronger and more easterly, in other words, toward the west, at higher altitudes, and then they drift away. So that's quite a reasonable possibility.
Question, slide 60.
Another question.
Yes, this is Matthew again with the Saturn Observation Campaign. I'm looking at slide 60. I have a very fundamental question. How do scientists determine where the prime meridian, and how they determine where the prime meridian is on Saturn's atmosphere, since it's not a fixed land?
No, I understand the question.
Okay.
You don't have a solid planet, so you can't just decide that Greenwich is the prime meridian the way we can on Earth. Well, that's a big problem, and it's still an unanswered question. I have some remarks on that at the end. With the other three giant planets, the magnetic field of the planet is tipped relative to the rotation axis of the planet. And so, like a wobbling top, all the phenomena that are associated with the magnetic field, all the charged particles, all the radiation belts, wobble once a day. That's true of Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune. And that wobble is detectable from Earth, or in the case of Jupiter, and very clear, detectable from spacecraft. And so we define the internal rotation of the planet from the magnetic field, since the magnetic field is generated inside the planet. And so that becomes our reference frame, and that substitutes for a solid planet, and that defines our prime meridian. And then it's just an arbitrary decision, sort of as it was on Earth. Once you know your reference frame, you just pick some place to be the prime meridian, and on Earth there was a little bit of politicking going on between Paris and Greenwich, but for some reason the English won. And so on Saturn there's no such politicking, but there is a prime meridian. And on Jupiter there is a prime meridian, and Uranus and Neptune too. Unfortunately for Saturn, however, the magnetic field is not tipped, and so there's no wobble. And therefore, although we can see things moving in the atmosphere, we can't decide what reference frame to use to measure the wind. And there are electrical currents outside the planet, and those generate magnetic fields, but they don't come from inside the planet. And so we thought after Voyager that we had measured the internal magnetic field and had detected a wobble or a tilt or anomaly or something. And it turns out we were detecting external field instead, and that period has changed over the years, and there's no way the inside of the planet could change its rotation. So we really don't have a reference frame for Saturn.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'll talk more about how we hope to get it.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, now there's a picture here, nighttime on Saturn. This is a very rare picture, a very rare opportunity where the sun was behind the planet relative to the spacecraft, as viewed from the spacecraft. The sun was not directly behind the center of the planet. It was sort of in the 7 o'clock position, halfway from the center. And you can even see a little piece of the sun where the sunlight is getting bent over the horizon by the atmosphere. And you can see a little piece of the sun peeping out. It's not, the sun isn't at that location. It's further towards the center of the planet. But you're looking at the night side of Saturn. And you can see that it's not pitch black over most of the night side. The only place that it's pitch black is over the North Pole. And that's because the rings are not visible. The rings cannot shine their light on the North Pole, or the South Pole for that matter, because they're over the horizon. You just imagine yourself standing right on the North Pole. You're looking straight out to the left or the right in this picture, and the rings, to see the rings, you'd have to look down, and the horizon's in the way. So the only place dark enough to detect lightning is in the North Pole, and we've looked there, and there wasn't any lightning. The storms that I showed you are all in the southern hemisphere, and they're all at the same latitude, about 35 degrees south latitude. So it's the ring shine that is confounding our efforts to visually see lightning. The reason the rings look so different is that this outer ring is not normally visible. It's only visible in this extreme geometry where the sun is almost directly behind the Saturn system. And this outer ring is made of very small particles that scatter light in a forward direction. And it's the E-ring. It's the result of stuff that's coming off the little moon Enceladus. And actually, Enceladus is in this picture at about the 8 o'clock position on the E-ring. There's a little tiny white dot. That's Enceladus. All right. So that's the problem, is this very bright night side of the planet. Now, switch gears here. South Polar Hurricane. Whether to call it a hurricane or not is kind of risky, because terrestrial meteorologists feel they know what a hurricane is, and of course they do, and they sort of bristle at us borrowing their favorite term. But this thing of the South Pole does have an eye, and it has very steep and very high clouds around the eye. Next slide is another one of these false color images showing cloud heights. And it has a double eye, actually. The inner eye is sort of oblong. It's not circular. And the outer eye is that circular region. The purple color, or violet color perhaps, is deep clouds. The greenish color in this false color image is high clouds, and so you can see that there's a sudden transition. There's a sort of a wall of clouds around each of these two eyes. I don't think this is a movie on your screen. If it is a movie, see if you can play it. I don't think it is. Let's move on. So this eye and the eye wall clouds is one feature that makes it like a hurricane. Another feature that makes it like a hurricane, I'll list the ones that make it different from a hurricane, that they're sort of obvious. It's not in the tropics, and it's anchored to the poles. That's the most obvious difference. And there's no ocean to power it. But the next slide, which is labeled temperature and anomaly, shows temperature as a function of latitude in the South Pole, in the southern hemisphere. And if you look at the anomaly is just the difference from the mean. So you can see that it's warm, the red color, right over on the right side of this figure. Within a few degrees, 2 degrees of the planet, it's several degrees Celsius or Kelvin warmer than the further south at the same pressure level. That's the vertical coordinate is pressure, basically altitude. And so you can see this warm core stretches up from the troposphere, where the pressures are sort of like Earth's atmosphere pressures. 1,000 millibars is the sea level pressure on Earth. And this warm core stretches all the way up into the stratosphere of Saturn, where the pressures are a few millibars. The warm core of a terrestrial hurricane does not go up that high. It sort of stops at the bottom of the stratosphere. But the values, several degrees warmer, up to 5 degrees warmer, are maybe similar to a terrestrial hurricane. Next slide shows a time sequence over 2.83 hours of watching those two inner rings. The arrow, the white arrow, is the direction of the incident sunlight. And we're watching this thing over 2.83 hours, and the sun changes its position in the sky. And the time sequence, as you can tell, goes down the page and then shifts over to the middle column and then down the page and then shifts over to the right column. And the sun shifts around, and the shadows cast by these high eye wall clouds also shift around. You can see by the end, the shadows are shifted to around in a sort of counterclockwise direction by 90 degrees, and they basically following the sun. And from the length of the shadows, we can determine how high the, rather crudely, this is not a precise measurement, but we can we take what data we can get, and this is the data that you're looking at. We can determine pretty clearly how high the clouds are, and they're very high. Next slide, one's labeled inner wall and the other is labeled outer wall, shows that some of the inner wall, especially the eye wall heights, get up to 100 kilometers. Now, on Earth, the eye wall of a terrestrial hurricane gets up to about 15 kilometers. So these are indeed very high clouds on Saturn. So we're trying to study and actually model using borrowing terrestrial models of terrestrial hurricanes and modifying them to have no ocean underneath, trying to understand how you get these wall eyes with walls when you don't have an ocean underneath. It's a different mechanism, but same physics, different setting, but same physics. And it's a puzzle, ongoing. Next, an old friend reappeared from the distant past. The distant past, in this case, being Voyager, 1981 period, which saw in the northern hemisphere a hexagon-like cloud circling the poles. This is a lot bigger. The eye and the eye walls that I just was talking about in the southern hemisphere sort of centered on latitude 88 degrees So they're 2 degrees in radius, but centered on the poles. The hexagon, if it were a circle, would be at latitude 75 degrees north, so it means a lot bigger structure. The northern hemisphere has been in darkness for a long time, and the spacecraft has not had some good views of the northern hemisphere. But the first instruments to detect the hexagon detected it in thermal radiation, and of course atmospheres give off thermal radiation. This is in the infrared, whether it's day or night. So putting together images from the thermal radiation revealed the hexagon. The next slide, labeled Saturn North Pole, Kevin Baines Cassini VIMS instrument. That is a movie, and see if you can play it.
I think on the way the people calling in, they needed to download the movie from the page.
So if you did,
yeah.
If you did, then you'll see it. I'll let you struggle with it. It's a I'm going to stop it. The still that starts the movie is just shows the hexagon sort of peeking out of the page on the right, and then as the movie plays, it appears that you're seeing motion in the clouds, but what you're actually seeing is the spacecraft flying from north of the pole down toward the equator, and you're just seeing the motion of the spacecraft. The next slide, which is a beautiful red with a blue circle, is another one of these false color images where the red is thermal radiation, infrared radiation from the clouds, and actually, to be more precise, it's radiation from below the clouds peeping through the holes in the clouds. So anything that looks red there is... and it's been... let me see here. I think it's been reversed so that the... whoa. You think I'd do my own homework. I'm going to figure this out. It is... No, it's indeed what I said. The red is the regions of high infrared emission, and the thicker clouds are blocking the infrared emission from below. You can see the hexagon there in sort of a black shape. The blue is an aurora at a totally different wavelength, also infrared, but it's sensitive to a totally different altitude in Saturn's atmosphere, much higher than these clouds. And it's the heat from the aurora that is shown in blue. And the obvious question is there any connection? The aurora is upper atmosphere. The clouds are in the troposphere, much lower down, hundreds of kilometers separation in vertical distance seems very unlikely. The aurora is associated with charged particles from outside the planet following the magnetic field line crashing into the upper atmosphere. And why the aurora should have anything to do with the hexagon, or maybe the reverse is true, why the hexagon should have anything to do with those charged particles, it is very hard to imagine. I personally don't think there's any connection except sort of a coincidence here. Why is there a hexagon if it's not associated with the aurora? Well, that too is a mystery. Prevailing wisdom is that it's some kind of a wave in the atmosphere, and a wave has to join onto itself if it's a wave around a latitude circle. So it's a wave with a certain wavelength, and it so happens that six cycles of the wave fit into that latitude circle. If the wavelength had been a little longer, it only would have been five. So that we could have had a hexagon, a pentagon, a heptagon, just depending on the wavelength of that. Now, what excites the wave, keeps it going, and we thought that maybe there's a storm there that's causing the jet streams to deflect around the storm, and that sets off a wave that closes on itself after six oscillations. That's the theory, but no one has successfully modeled it in a computer simulation. Next slide. As the northern hemisphere comes into sunlight, we're beginning to see visible views of the hexagon, and this shows a fairly recent image of the northern hemisphere, and you can see a corner of the hexagon beginning to peek out of the darkness. And as the sun illuminates more of the northern hemisphere, you'll see more of the hexagon. The equinox, when the sun is just rising at the pole itself, is in August of 2009, just a little more than a year away. And like the southern hemisphere, next slide, right at the pole, you can see there's a little hot spot. Right at the pole, it's about the same size as the southern hemisphere hot spot. In this image, temperature map of Saturn's north pole, hot spot from 89 degree latitude to the pole. You can see the hexagon sort of surrounding that little hot spot. And it may be that these are very similar phenomena. Obviously, having a hot spot at the pole is sort of counterintuitive because, well, Earth's pole is cold because there's less sunlight there, and there has to be some fluid dynamical heating going on. It can't be direct sunlight heating that little hot spot and making it warm, because after all, the northern hemisphere has not been getting any sunlight for 15 years. So there's some fluid dynamical heating mechanism going on, which we'd love to understand. Next, there's something on Earth called the quasi-biennial oscillation. That means it reappears, or it's an oscillation that has a period of approximately 2 years. It averages a little longer than that. And it consists of an oscillation in the wind's speed and direction over the equator, not just the equator, but the whole tropical region. The winds blow from the west for a year, and then they reverse and blow from the east for a year, and then they reverse again. And the phasing of the oscillation shifts downward, so that the winds will the oscillation will start up at high altitudes, and then this so that the westerly winds, say, will start at high altitudes, and then half a year later the winds will be westerly at somewhat lower altitudes, and half a year later than that it'll be westerly at even lower altitudes. And this is a pattern that rings all around the Earth, and there are accompanying temperature changes. The equator is warmer than the latitudes on either side for a year, and then it's colder than the latitudes on either side. Well, we can't measure the winds as a function of altitude, or really the stratospheric winds on Saturn at all, or only indirectly, because we need to really do a good job. We need little clouds that we can watch. And in the stratosphere, we don't have such clouds. But we do measure the temperatures. And the next slide shows that over a sort of 9-year period, the temperatures have reversed. Obviously, this is not Cassini data. This is taken from the Earth using the infrared telescope. And the aspect of Saturn has changed over this period, but look at the line labeled equator. Compare it with the line labeled 13 degrees south latitude. In 1997, the equator was colder than 13 degrees south latitude. And in 2006, the equator was warmer than 13 degrees south latitude. And it appears that this is a, this is spanning a 9-year period, so maybe it's an 18-year oscillation. And Cassini has been participating in this study, looking for reversals in the winds, and certainly verifying some of these temperature changes, although they were discovered from Earth before Cassini. And it's a very nice example of Earth-based astronomers contributing to a Cassini mission, and then Cassini, because it's up close and obtaining detailed observations, is helping to further collect data and hopefully lead to some understanding of this oscillation. Okay, next slide goes back to the Earth and shows you this oscillation over a multi-year period, 25 years, and you can see the red color is a westerly wind, that means blowing to the east, and then the blue color is the easterly wind blowing to the east, blowing to the west, and you can see how the And you could obtain this picture at almost any longitude because it circles the planet. But you can see how the winds oscillate and how this pattern starts at the high altitudes and then shifts downwards as time goes by. So again, we're trying to understand phenomena that we thought we understood on Earth, but in a much different context, and you learn stuff. Often you learn that your terrestrial understanding was based on a house of cards, but it's sometimes very humiliating, sometimes very illuminating to study things that you thought you understood. This just shows the oscillation, now back to Saturn, how it seems to be oscillating with time. Okay. I told you about how we don't have a reference frame for our Saturn winds. There's a hope to find one, and that is if you get close enough to the planet, you might detect a very small tilt in the magnetic field. It has got to be a small tilt because we would have detected anything larger. But a very small tilt is possibly hidden there. And if we're very close to the planet, we might be able to detect it. And so, independently, the project has been ruminating about how to end the mission and how to dispose of the spacecraft. You don't want to contaminate a moon like Enceladus, which has biological potential. You don't want to contaminate it with a bunch of terrestrial microbes. So the best place to dispose of the spacecraft is into the planet where it'll burn up. And that means you've got to spend some time in close to the planet. And so we are seriously discussing skimming over the atmosphere. The next slide says end of mission scenario. On the left, you can see the view from above the system, and you can see the rings A, B, the D, and then in between the D ring and the planet, there's a white space. A white space. That area seems to be devoid of ring particles, and therefore you could send a spacecraft through there. Now, the right panel shows the kind of orbit, a typical high inclination orbit, which even at its closest approach does not get in to skimming the atmosphere. It has to stay outside the ring. But you could take one of these high inclination orbits and perturb it with a little thruster firing and send it just skimming over the atmosphere between the D-ring and the planet. And the next slide shows another spacecraft. It's on the books, called Juno, which is slated to orbit Jupiter in a decade or so. And it has a similar... Now, Jupiter doesn't have the same enormous ring system, but this is a successive orbit of Jupiter by the Juno spacecraft. Well, if you just imagine this diagram with make it Saturn and put in Saturn's rings and say that these trajectories are going between the D-ring and the atmosphere, you'd have our end-of-mission scenario. And when you're in that close, you can detect the magnetic field, you can hopefully detect you can detect any anomalies and any tilt that exists. You can also measure the gravity field with exquisite accuracy. And the magnetic field and the gravity field tell us about the interior of the planet, something that's very hard to get at, but you got to be close. And really, I think I'll stop right there. I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Andy. Does anybody have any questions?
Is anyone still there?
Yeah.
This is Don from Don O'Coin from Bangalore. The hexagon that we see at the pole, do you believe that it will change when the tilt changes?
When the sunlight starts illuminating it.
Right.
It was detected by Voyager when it was in sunlight. And so my guess is, and it's lasted for over 20 years, so my guess is it'll still be there.
Okay, so it's a permanent fixture.
Yeah, well, nothing, you know,
well,
atmospheric features are not permanent. It's remarkable how long they live on the giant planets compared with storms on Earth.
Right.
The Great Red Spot is 300 years old, and it is shrinking right now. So it's possible that after 300 years, it's lived its life. We don't know what's going to happen to any of these features.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, if we don't have any more questions, we'll thank Andy, and then he can get off to his seminar, and then we can greet Zibby to talk about icy moons. And for that, everyone will need to go back to page 17 of your PowerPoint. That's where the Saturn icy moon section picks up. And thank you, Andy, so much. I think he's already gone. And Zibby, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh,
yep.
Great. Okay, super. So I already introduced you a little bit earlier from APL. You've just recently moved from Lunar and Planetary Lab. I don't know how recently, but...
Yeah, it's been a couple of years, actually. Almost.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Well,
time flies.
Time flies when you're having fun. Okay, so take it away.
Okay, the 18th slide shows a discovery that was announced in the last year, which is that the imaging experiment on Cassini detected the 60th moon identified around Saturn, and you can see it outlined in that little red box there. It's not a very big moon, it's only a few kilometers across, but it's the 60th, and that's kind of a nice round number. There's also, the movies aren't in the presentation, but there is a movie that shows the motion of the various satellites here in the Discovery. That the motion is what demonstrates that it's a satellite of Saturn. And if you go to the Cassini website, you can find that.
I'll add that movie to the page where the Charm Telecon is.
Okay.
But I'll do it after the fact.
Yeah, the PIA number is 08369 for people who want to look at it.
369. Great. But I'll add that in the next day or so.
Thank you. And there are a couple others that I a couple of other slides in here where movies I've actually cited the photo journal number
right
at the bottom so people can find them.
Yeah, we added the Enceladus plume one, so.
Great. Thank you.
That one's in there. Okay.
The next slide, number 19, shows some of the other small satellites. These are a little larger than the one that was discovered most recently, but these are nonetheless small for satellites. And they have a fairly unusual shape in that they actually look a lot like flying saucers. And there were some papers published this year, the citations are at the bottom of the slide, describing that the shapes of these satellites are within the ring system. And the shapes of the satellites are consistent with the satellites consisting of a core. And you can kind of see, especially in the second picture of Atlas there, looking down on the top, you can kind of see a central part of the body that's a little rougher. And then the saucer part is actually a little smoother. And the models indicate that these may be more spherical bodies that then have kilometers of material deposited is kind of collected around the center, around the equators, to form these unique shapes. Going on to the next slide, there were several close encounters with the various larger icy satellites in the Saturnian system, and I'm going to talk about some of the results from those. Actually, the first set of slides here are images of Dione. We didn't have a very close encounter with Dione, but nonetheless did observe it throughout the last year. And these observations show the fracture system on Dione and the craters. And we've recently released a map of the surface of Dione that has been observed so far, and that's on the 22nd slide. You can see the fracture system wrapping around. As Andy mentioned, we still haven't gotten to the equinox in the northern vernal equinox in the Saturnian system yet. That will happen in August 2004. So the 2009. Sorry. So you'll see in the maps in this presentation that the northern latitudes are not well imaged yet, and that's because they're not completely illuminated yet. And as we proceed towards the vernal equinox in another year, we'll be getting more and more coverage of the northern territory. The next slide has an image of Tethys, of a crater several tens of kilometers in diameter on the surface of Tethys, taken during the close encounter last summer. And there is another, the slide following that also shows a fairly dramatic high phase angle view. There are two of those, the crescent of Tethys. The one on slide 24 is a fairly high resolution, and then slide 25 is pulling back away from Tethys. The 26th slide shows the big fracture system on Tethys, Ithaca Chasma. It's quite a dramatic structure. You can actually see on the 27th slide, which is the full map of Tethys that we released earlier this year, the extent of this system. It's really quite a huge it wraps almost half the way around almost all the way around the planet, and it's quite deep. One of the things that has come out of the recent imaging of Tethys is that a group on the imaging team has counted the number of smaller craters. You can see that there's a very large crater up Odysseus up in the upper left of the map. And that's actually kind of the relationship of where that is on the satellite with respect to where Ithaca Chasma wraps around the satellite is very intriguing. But one of the things that you can do is look at the smaller craters, and if you go back to some of the other images, you can see that the surface of Tethys is just covered with craters of different sizes. And you can look at the number of craters per area on different parts of the satellite to get a feel for the relative ages, because the cratering rate should be consistent and fairly consistent across the surface of the body throughout time. So one of the things that's come out of this study that was published in the last year was that the cratering, the number of craters per area in Ithaca Chasma is actually slightly higher than the number of craters per area in the large crater Odysseus. And it had been hypothesized that the geometry wasn't a coincidence, but this would suggest that it is, because that it suggests that the crater is actually younger and that therefore is slightly younger and that therefore the two are not related genetically, which makes the chasma all the more puzzling. There was also, if you go on to the next slide, slide 28, there was a close encounter with Rhea. And you can see on the 29th slide some of the high-resolution images from that encounter. Especially intriguing on the left-hand side, you can see the sun in the in the image on the left-hand side, the sun is illuminating the surface from the left. And you can see at the top that there's a slope that's exposed and illuminated, and that there's actually, it looks like a tongue of material has flowed down from that. So this is looks like a small landslide that's occurred on Rhea, mass wasting being one of the primary mechanisms of erosion. Obviously, cratering is clearly happening on the surface as well, but that slope has clearly been degraded also by some landsliding down it. The 30th slide shows a stereo view of an impact crater on Rhea. It's on the leaning hemisphere of Rhea, and if you look, and I should have put in a picture of a global picture of Rhea, because there's an impact crater that's actually quite young that has rays extending out from it, and this is actually that crater shown close up. Rays are known to form many satellites. And in fact, craters on the moon, you can see this as well on our moon, that the youngest craters have rays and they fade with time. So this is a thought to be quite a young crater, relatively speaking, on Rhea. And you can see, if you have stereo glasses available, there's actually a central peak structure, and again, there's been some collapse downward of material. And there are a number of very small craters superimposed that may be secondaries from the cratering events. There was also a very exciting discovery announced this year there may be the data from the Cassini encounters with Rhea are consistent with there being a ring of material around Rhea itself. This is something that's going to be discussed in the next installment of the fourth anniversary telecon, so I just wanted to mention that. It will be discussed next time.
Oh, good.
So one of the really exciting encounters of this year, and of course all of the satellites are exciting in their own right, but I'm a big fan of Iapetus, and so one of the most exciting encounters for me was the one last September with Iapetus. This is the only close encounter with Iapetus in the mission. There was a very distant one, a fairly distant one, at the end of December 2004, and the image on slide 32 shows what we saw of Iapetus from that encounter. and that was a really exciting encounter. But the one in last September was much, much closer. So one of the things that's been known about Iapetus for a long time is that one of the sides of Iapetus is dark, and the other side is quite bright. And on slide 32, you see an image of Iapetus from the earlier distant encounter that Cassini had with Iapetus. And this is an image of the dark side. This is the image that really this is the encounter that really reveals this ridge that runs along the equator of Iapetus. What we saw in the encounter last September, as shown in slide 33, is the other side of Iapetus. So this is a really good view of the other side. We could see map out how the ridge progresses along that side and look at the transition between the dark and the bright material and get a good look at the bright side. And we got some really spectacular and not only scientifically important but also just aesthetically pleasing images of the surface of Iapetus. Slide 34 shows a higher resolution view of the bright and dark transition area that you can see in the global view on slide 33. This is just kind of zooming in. And then 35 shows another higher resolution image, and then 36 has several images of both the bright terrain, which has some dark material deposited on it, and vice versa. And it's really just a spectacular place. The 37th slide shows an observation made by Sears, which is measuring the surface temperature of Iapetus across this transition region. And this is really important for understanding what is causing the albedo contrast that we see. And this flyby really provided a lot of important data to confirm hypotheses about this. You can see that the dark material is much higher in temperature than the bright material. The red rectangle shows you where the Sears data fall on the visible imaging map. So the dark areas are much warmer. Similar, you know, as anything with that's dark, it will absorb the heat much more effectively than something that is bright. And this is the part of the key to why Iapetus has this color dichotomy. The dark areas are actually warm enough that over a billion years, you can about 20 meters of just water ice, which is primarily what the surface components of Iapetus is. 20 meters would evaporate or sublime from the surface at those temperatures of about 130 Kelvin. That doesn't sound like a lot, maybe over a billion years, but it really is. In the bright areas, they're much cooler and only about 10 centimeters, so an order of magnitude less ice will actually be able to sublime from the bright areas because they're cooler. So this supports the hypothesis that one of the things causing the bright dark hemispheres on Iapetus is that the dark material is actually the darker areas are warm enough that ice sublimes and then is redeposited in the bright region, and that kind of process it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The darker the area gets, the less ice there is, the warmer it can be. And this is also helped by the fact that Iapetus has a very long rotation period, 78 days. So the part of Iapetus that is illuminated and can warm up for a long time. They also got temperature maps. I don't have them here, but they also did map the night side Sears maps the temperatures of the night side as well, and those are consistent with a very fluffy material that cools off quite quickly. Let's see, there's one other. So the next slide shows observations of Iapetus that were made by UVIS in the, this is an ultraviolet imaging spectrometer, and these are a couple of different maps showing what UVIS saw. UVIS is looking at the composition of the materials on Iapetus, and those maps show differences in the materials. And the UVIS observations are also consistent with this hypothesis that the volatiles are being lost at low latitudes and transported to the colder high latitudes. They're also able to look at differences in the composition within the dark and the bright areas to try to see how much it varies across that. The 39th slide has a similar observation made by the visual imaging mapping spectrometer, visible and infrared mapping spectrometer, sorry. They too are looking at the composition of Iapetus, but in the infrared part of the spectrum. And these are their observations show that most of Iapetus is composed of water ice, but there's a stronger signature of carbon dioxide in the dark terrain, and there are also some trace amounts of other organic materials and possibly ammonia, although they're still trying to sort out the calibration to confirm that. There are also some spectral features that actually don't match any of the compounds that are known or in the databases to which they're comparing the observations, and that's pretty intriguing, especially because a lot of those features are also observed in the dark material on some of the other satellites, especially the outer satellites, Phoebe, Dione, and in the ring. So it suggests that the origin of some of this material is the same for various parts of the Saturnian system. So that's interesting that those are consistent. One of the big questions is what the origin of the dark material is. I mentioned that it becomes kind of this runaway process, that you get a dark area and that it becomes warmer, and then it becomes harder for ice to persist in that area, and you get this runaway process where the ice is transported from the dark areas to the bright areas. But that needs an initial deposition of dark material to get it started. So one of the things that's interesting, and you'll see in some of the upcoming slides, which are also images of Iapetus up close, starting with slide 40, this is an image of the ridge that runs around the equator, or most of the equator of Iapetus. But in the center top, you'll see that there's a small, bright impact crater. And we can use the impact craters to assess the thickness of the dark material on the surface of Iapetus. Most of these craters actually don't have a strong albedo difference. So there's that one, and there really are only a handful of these little bright craters that are punching through. The fact that they're small indicates that the layer isn't that thick, that they can punch through it, that even the smaller craters can punch through it. And now that we have these really high-resolution images of Iapetus, you can see that even craters on a scale of several tens of meters are punching through, which suggests that this material is only maybe several meters deep before you get down to the brighter ice underneath it. And that, of course, begs the question of why the larger craters are still dark, which suggests that not only was there some has material been in place on Iapetus to start this process of transport of the ice away from the dark region. But it must continually be being in place such that it's coating the larger craters again. And this is consistent with some of the other instruments observations like UVIS and SPHERES as well. So the 41st slide also shows a nice high-resolution view of Iapetus. And the 42nd slide shows the map that we can now put together because we've seen both hemispheres fairly well. The ridge runs most of the way around, but it isn't complete. In some areas, it's interrupted at about 30 degrees west longitude. You can see that the ridge is interrupted by a huge impact basin. In other areas, it may not, if it doesn't exist or we don't see the ridge, but there isn't necessarily an impact crater there to obscure it. It's not clear what the origin of this ridge is. It's surprisingly difficult to explain how a feature like this, which is clearly a fundamental feature to Iapetus, how it formed, and that's something that's still being researched. One of the other things I should mention about Iapetus is that we actually Cassini approached Iapetus during this flyby from the unilluminated side, but the radar instrument was actually mapping Iapetus at that time, and so we have a radar map of Iapetus, and we have radar observations of the radar observations of the surface, because they can probe into the subsurface of Iapetus to some extent, also give us information about the mixing, the characteristics of the dark and bright materials on the surface of Iapetus and the mixing, and so that's going to be very interesting as well. The 43rd slide shows one of our best images of Epimetheus, which is a small satellite. It's about 100 kilometers in it's about 100 kilometers in diameter. And it's clearly a cratered body, but it's not completely covered in craters. In fact, it has a lot of areas that aren't cratered, which is interesting. You can also see that there are a couple of different units of material. There seems to be this kind of gray material that's collecting down in the bottoms of craters by mass wasting, and maybe in other low areas on the surface. And last but certainly not least, there was a very close encounter just this past March with Enceladus. The image on slide 44 is actually an older image, one of our kind of best global views of Enceladus, demonstrating the incredible diversity of the landforms on its surface, including the this is a very false color, very enhanced color view, but including the tiger stripes down at the South Pole. And the 45th slide, again, is an image from one of those earlier encounters that shows those tiger stripes a little closer. Later, just a few months after that image was taken, this movie was put together of the plumes on Enceladus. And by looking at how the if you download that movie from the website, you can see that the plumes move, and you can use that parallax caused by the motion of the spacecraft you can trace back to where the sources of those plumes must be on the surface. And the slide 47, the image on that slide, shows the results of an analysis done by Joseph Talley and Carolyn Porco that was published last year. It's a very busy graphic, but the yellow Roman numerals show the places where the sources of those plumes must be to be consistent with the parallax that's observed as you in that movie. The red diamonds, or some of the the smaller diamonds actually show the where the Sears instrument has seen hot spots as well. And you can see there's a good correlation there. And Sears got more data. This is from the earlier encounter. Sears got more data in the more recent encounter, and I'll be getting to that. So you can see that that the plume sources are correlated with the locations, for the most part, of the tiger stripes. Just last fall, you can see on slide 48 on the left an image of Enceladus that was taken, and on the right a graphic illustrating the path of a star that Uvis watched as it traversed behind the plume. And this is a really important observation. The 49th slide shows the track of the star as kind of shown above the surface of Enceladus, and again those same plume sources are listed. So one of the really important things that came out of this observation made by the UVIS instrument had to do with the size of the particles at this altitude above the surface of Enceladus, because the Cassini spacecraft flew quite close to Enceladus in the encounter in March, and of course we want to make sure that it's safe to get that close to the source of the plume. The encounter in March, the closest approach was to only 50 kilometers, but that wasn't over the plumes. Cassini was higher than that over the plumes, I think about 250 kilometers. Nonetheless, that's close, and we want to make sure it's safe. So that was one of the really important results to come out of that that observation. The next slide actually shows those encounters. On the left is a graphic of the 2005 Enceladus plume observations, and on the right is a graphic showing Enceladus and the plumes and the paths of Cassini's various encounters. So we've actually only had three of these encounters so far, the one in kind of teal that labeled E3 is the one from this past March, and there are several more encounters with Enceladus planned for Cassini's extended mission for the next couple of years, some of which will get closer in within the plumes. From the March flyby, the slide on page 51 shows the results from the ion and neutral mass spectrometer, which actually measures the composition of material as it passes through it. This instrument is actually also very very important for understanding Titan's upper atmosphere and the composition of that. But it's wonderful for flying through Enceladus plumes and understanding what the materials within that are. And of course, there's a lot of water vapor. That's what seems to be driving the plumes. Although the actual mechanism for that is still being debated, there's primarily water vapor, but there's also a fair amount of organics. And intriguingly, the organic composition is actually closest to that of comets, which would not have been expected for, first of all, a satellite in the Saturnian system, which is likely to have gone through the formation of the Saturnian system and therefore would not be expected to be as primitive as a comet, and also a satellite that is clearly active and therefore has gone through a fair amount of thermal processing as well. So to have a fairly primitive composition of material being expelled from within is a puzzle. One of the other observations from the encounter last March is higher resolution views of the surface temperatures. Sears saw that in the very first Enceladus encounters, saw that the South Pole was much warmer than one would expect for a small icy body sitting at that distance from the sun. And on slide 53, you can see one of their higher resolution observations from this most recent encounter. The asterisks again indicate the locations of the triangulated plume sources, and you can see that those correlate with these warm regions along that run for the most part along the tiger stripe, right along those fractures, and the temperatures on the surface there are about 180 kelvins. The peak temperature is about 180 kelvins, which is surprisingly high for such a small satellite. The equilibrium temperature at this distance from the sun is 72 kelvins. So it's clearly very, very warm compared to what you would expect for the surface of Enceladus. The last slide I have actually in the discussion of the satellites is actually Enceladus Northern Territory, and as I've said, and Andy said, we're only just the northernmost portions of Saturn and the satellites are only just becoming illuminated as we get towards northern spring. The northern part of Enceladus is very, very different from the southern part. It's quite cold, and it has a lot of impact craters. If you compare that to some of the images of the South Pole, the South Polar Terrain of Enceladus basically has no impact craters at the resolutions we've observed it at. And if you look at the North Pole, it has a lot of impact craters. Moreover, those impact craters are deformed in a way consistent with relaxation. This is something that can happen if the ice is warm enough to be mobile over geologic time. And clearly for Enceladus, that's the case. And that also provides really important information as to the geologic history of Enceladus and its interior conditions. So we'll be really looking forward to viewing the northern hemisphere of Enceladus as it comes out of the winter darkness and mapping and completing the map of Enceladus. The next Enceladus encounter is, I believe, August 11th, so that's coming up quite soon and should be very exciting. So I'll leave that there and take any questions.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Parker Moreland, McCarthy Observatory. A couple of simple questions. One, are all the icy satellites that you have been going through, Libby, phase locked with Saturn?
Yes, they are all. All the ones I've been speaking about are. It turns out Titan may not be, and that's something that I'll talk about in next month.
Okay. But certainly Enceladus and Iapetus are phase locked, and
yep.
So they have a leading
yes,
side.
They do.
Now, I have a question that's been bothering me since it came out, and that's slide 61. It was actually earlier, but I hesitated to delay our speaker then. The eclipse slide. I cannot understand.
This is the nighttime on Saturn slide.
Nighttime on Saturn.
Yeah,
61
number 61
in
Andy's presentation.
Right.
It's the solar eclipse from Cassini.
Right.
Right.
Uh-huh.
I've been looking at that for years, and I cannot understand why I can see rings in front of Saturn in the dark. They're offset from the rings that are coming around, but I still see rings here on the dark side. Is that some kind of a reflection phenomenon of the light bouncing off of these near side rings back onto Saturn and making it appear that I'm seeing rings in front of Saturn, even though, you know, I can't be. It's dark here, I guess.
The image in that slide, that one is very stretched. Doesn't mean those are artifacts. It's just that you're seeing you're seeing very faint features. But there is a reflection from the rings of light back onto Saturn, and there is also scattering from dust that's illuminating part of that. So I think the source of illumination there is reflection onto the night side of Saturn and maybe reflection.
The same problem that he was worried about. He can't get a nice dark thing for his lightning strike.
Right.
But the alignment is such that it almost looks like you have continuous rings into a shadow area. And so it can be a little disconcerting at first. Okay,
and the rings look very different in different lighting conditions. So.
Right.
So just to clarify that a little bit, we did a charm telecon with Matt Hedman, and I'm just bringing it up right now, where he talked for about 20 minutes about this image alone. And he drew like 20 different slides where he drew every line of sight from the sun, hitting the rings, hitting the planet, going through the rings and being and getting to your eye. It was fantastic. And I'm just looking to see when this was. It's been recent. Oh, Jane, help me.
Okay, let me get there.
Saturn's rings, large and small, was that it?
Let me see.
Probing Mysteries Iapetus, no. We had so many great charm telecons. It was in October, I thought. No, it can't be October. Well, you know what? Of course, I've interrupted the whole talk. And
yeah.
But if you just go back, there is a terrific charm telecon, and I'm almost certain that it's Saturn's rings, large and small, on July 31st, 2007, where Matt talks about that.
I'm pulling it up just to see if that's what it is.
And it's just, this image can fascinate you for hours. And but that's exactly what's happening, is the sunlight is coming in, it's hitting the rings, it's bouncing off the rings and hitting the planet and making the southern hemisphere of the planet a little bit brighter, and bouncing off the planet and headed back towards your eyes, but of course the rings are still in the way. So there you see the shadow of the rings. So the rings are actually blocking your view of the southern hemisphere on that band where they look dark, right in the middle of the image. And it's a completely real. This image is completely real. The only parts of this image that are image artifacts are the very weird streaks that are outside of the planet itself.
The propellers.
Trina, this is Kirk. That charm was on 11/28/2006.
11/28/2006. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I was just digging that up.
A new perspective of Saturn's rings, yes. So if you go to where you downloaded the presentation and take a look at Matt's presentation from November 28th, 2006, he literally has 14 pages where he lays out this image, and it is well worth the time to take a look at it.
We'll do it. Thank you so much. I'm glad I asked the question.
Question and comment.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, this is Matthew again with the Saturn Observation Campaign. On slide number 48, it's really intriguing about Enceladus's plume. The graphic representation on the right shows the location of the plumes in relation to the entire satellite, and it's in the south polar region. My assumption is there's no other plumes that have been detected on any other areas of that moon, which begs the question, does that particular plume have any effect on Enceladus's orbit? Because I believe you're showing the velocity vector with that arrow, the orbital velocity vector.
The arrow is actually showing
the star.
That's just showing the path the star took behind the behind the plume.
Yeah, that's just the occultation.
Okay,
yeah.
I was thinking of comets and how they have jets, you know, and that the jets on comets actually change their trajectories and whatnot. Is there enough mass in these plumes to appreciably alter Enceladus's orbit?
I'm not an expert in that. It probably depends on your definition of appreciable. I don't think it's affecting the dynamics dramatically. I don't know if there's detectable, and I don't think we'd be able to detect it on the timescales that we're observing Enceladus. Over the longer timescale, it might be something that that would be detectable. I mean, over a very long timescale, probably not one we'd be able to do. But I'm not a dynamicist, I'm afraid. It is unique to the South Pole. There have not been plumes observed anywhere else on Enceladus. That's the part of Enceladus that is warm. And Sears has observed other parts of Enceladus, and they're not warm. The North Pole, for example, is because it hasn't been illuminated at all, is sitting down at something like 30, 40 kelvins. It's really quite cold. So this is completely anomalous. It may not be a coincidence that it's at the South Pole, in that if there is a difference in the shape or the mass distribution in Enceladus because of this activity, it might it's possible that the poles would rotate such that it or that that region would rotate such that it were at one of the poles from the dynamics. So it may not be a coincidence that it's at the pole. It may have happened because of the internal structure beneath this region. But it is the only area that's active now. There are some other areas on there's one or two other places on Enceladus that have similar looking tectonic features. The geology looks similar, and so it's been suggested that those might be areas that used to exhibit this kind of activity and that are no longer, and now this area that's currently at the South Pole is active. So it's possible that this has happened other places at other times, but the full geologic history of Enceladus is still being studied.
Okay. And then the comment is for slide number 46, Enceladus' plumes. I did go to the web page for the movie, and I just want to comment that to download the animated GIF file, you have to right-click over the image and do a save image as operation because the other options are TIF and JPEG format, which of course are not animated.
There's several places to get that that movie. There's in addition to the photo journal. That's
okay.
One place, and then there's also in the Cassini movies. It's also there too.
Okay, thank you.
It in four different formats of movies.
Thank you. Libby?
Uh-huh.
Parker Moreland again. It seems to me that we have to come up with a heat source for both Enceladus and Iapetus. What's the best thinking? Only thing I can think of is radioactivity, but what is everybody out there thinking about as a heat source to cause all this stuff?
It's harder for Enceladus than Iapetus.
Yes, it is.
Iapetus... Well, and it's not to say that Iapetus is simple, because the ridge on Iapetus and the shape of Iapetus actually really complicate that as well. It's something I didn't talk about today, but from the December 2004 encounter with Iapetus, you could see that the shape of Iapetus is actually much more oblate than you would expect, given the fact that it's got a 78-day rotation period, which suggests that the if I remember correctly, the shape of Iapetus is consistent with the hydrostatic equilibrium rotating at 17 hours. So that implies that it's frozen in to Iapetus, the Iapetus shape. Froze in and has persisted in that state despite the fact that Iapetus is now despawned and tidally locked for its distant orbit. So Iapetus has to have been warm enough to deform to that shape for the faster rotation rate, and probably has to, if the ridge is a tectonic feature, then that also has to be explained somewhere in there early on. And yet it has to have cooled fast enough that locked in and has been able to stay stable over 4 billion years of history. So the timing on Iapetus is actually quite tricky. To model that all using the short and long-lived radioactive species and get it to be warm at the right times and cold enough quickly enough that it froze in and has persisted is actually non-trivial.
So we don't think it was at one time close to Saturn and it got tidal heat like Io, and then somehow got knocked out to where it is now.
No.
Okay.
No, for Iapetus, it looks like it. I believe the history is such that it does not have to have moved significantly within the system. Enceladus is also hard to explain, and it depends. You can look at it, one way or the other. Either Enceladus or Mimas is hard to explain, because Mimas is actually slightly closer to Saturn, and yet it has no activity at all. It's got one of the oldest surfaces in the system. And so somehow these two satellites that are about the same and in about the same part of the Saturnian system have had hugely different histories. Again, for Enceladus, unless you appeal to Deus Ex Machina explanations for the plumes, and that's not out of the realm of possibility, of course, but we like to not have to rely on that as an explanation. The radioactivity and the tidal heating are sufficient to keep Enceladus warm if it never cooled off. So if there's this region on Enceladus that has persisted as warm throughout its history, I believe the most recent studies that I have heard the results of, you can keep it warm. There's enough tidal heating to maintain that heat through the history of Enceladus. But if it ever cooled off, there's not enough tidal heating through the evolution of its orbit and the orbits of the satellite, other satellites. There's not enough to heat it back up again without some external event. You're right. It too is difficult to explain, but it's possible that the radioactivity early on and there's given the radioactivity early on and the resonances, the tidal activity, there's enough of that to keep it warm if it never cooled off.
Thanks much.
Okay, if nobody has any other questions, let's thank Zibi for her really great talk. I loved having all the comparisons from all the other instruments besides ISS on that. It was a really, really nice presentation. Our next charm will be July 29th, where we'll cover the other three of the five Cassini science objectives. Today we covered Saturn and the icy satellites, and on July 29th we'll cover MAPS, the magnetospheric and plasma science results for the fourth year, rings, Titan, and Trina will wrap it all up with some cool gee whiz facts.
Okay.
Anybody have any other questions or comments?
Same time?
It's always the same time. Are you with, which group are you with?
McCarthy Observatory.
I mean, how did you get your invitation?
Oh, Museum.
Museum Alliance. Okay, great. Yes, the announcement that comes out every month says at the bottom that these are always at the same day. It's always the last Tuesday of the month. It's 11 to 1 p.m. And then the topics change every month. But you'll be getting another invitation from the Museum Alliance with all that information in a couple weeks. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.